Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hanna Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
Before we start, we would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions due to remote recording. Today, we are getting into the issue of climate-induced migration and displacement. To help us navigate this very current and pressing topic, we have with us here today Beatrice Mosello, Senior Advisor at Adelphi, and Gareth Price, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House. They are two of the four authors of the report Rethinking Human Mobility in the Face of Global Changes, which was prepared for the Cascades Project. The report is linked in this episode's description. Great to have you both on board.
Great to be on board. Thanks for having us. And hi, everyone.
Hello, looking forward to this.
So your report sets out to analyze some of the prevailing trends on human mobility in regards to climate change, as well as the role climate change plays in exacerbating fragility and conflict, which in turn also has an impact on human mobility. Can you tell us some of your main findings?
Yes, of course, Anna. Let's start from the basics. So what is our paper all about? In short, we kind of wanted to better understand the different ways in which mobility can serve as an adaptation strategy to climate and conflict-related risks and vulnerabilities. And we also wanted to stress test how effective mobility is as an adaptation strategy and will continue to be in light of other stresses, including the COVID-19 pandemic. We did come up with quite a few interesting findings. Maybe first of all, we saw that migration and displacement will indeed be aggravated by climate change, both through direct impacts, say people having to move because of increased drought and water stress conditions that have made agriculture no longer a viable activity for them and no alternatives are available, but also through its compounding effects on poverty, unemployment, and conflict, which we know drive already mobility worldwide. We also found that the linkages between climate change and mobility are more complex than we thought. So, for example, slow and sudden onset climate impacts lead to very different mobility patterns. If you take natural disasters, for example, these are typically linked to temporary reductions in financial means and livelihood constraints, which in turn led to internal migration. Instead, slow onset climate impacts combined with other economic and social factors, for example, high unemployment, tend to lead to longer term migration, often outside the region. We also found that migration and especially cross-border migration can have some important developmental impacts. For example, the remittances that migrants send back home can benefit both sending and receiving countries and help build resilience at the household and community level. But also we found that at the same time, a high dependence on remittances that can make the national economy and the economy of families, especially in rural areas, extremely vulnerable to sudden shocks and crises. So this dependence in a way needs to be supported by social policy and other investments. But I think we'll talk a bit more about this when we go into the case studies. Maybe do you have anything to add, Gareth?
Sure. I mean, we found that different demographic and social groups experience the interplay between climate change and mobility, and especially migration, differently. Women and poorer households are more likely to be trapped and unable to move because of financial, social, or physical barriers, despite their higher exposure to vulnerability to the impacts of climate change. And we found, I mean, that doing this study at the time of the COVID-19 pandemic and the related mobility restrictions introduced to contain its spread, increased unemployment in cities, reduced opportunities for seasonal work and remittance flows, and severely harmed the ability of climate vulnerable populations to use mobility as an effective adaptation strategy. But also our analysis demonstrated that mobility is not just a failure to cope with climatic and other changes that may be at play in a given context. Under the right circumstances, it can be an important and effective adaptation strategy if and only if it's accompanied by adequate investments in sustainable infrastructure and basic services, as well as social protection and economic opportunities for those who leave and for those that remain.
Thank you both so much. Now, another important aspect that the report sought to explore were narratives around migration. This included how media and policy debates depict the issue and at times also shape perceptions in negative directions. This can be a source of tensions itself. What was meant by that?
Yeah, very important point, Hannah. Indeed, there's been a lot of talking over the past 5 years or so about migration and displacement in general. Think of the inverted commas here, refugee crisis, that has been dominating our news outlets since 2015 or so. I talked about how climate change will make this world crisis, again, inverted commas, worse. There have been a few studies, for example, led by the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center and the World Bank, showing that already more people are displaced by disasters than by violence and conflict, 3 times more in 2019, to be precise. And also showing that if substantial climate change mitigation and development measures are not taken, slow onset climate impacts could displace as many as 143 million people in just 3 world regions, or 55% of the developing world's population by 2050. And these are really scary numbers, right? These analyses are very important to draw attention to the impacts of climate change and calling for mitigation and adaptation actions urgently. But I think the risk there is also that they can feed dangerous narratives that depict migration as a threat to our societies, justify militarized, security-focused responses to addressing the, again, inverted commas, threat of climate change impacts, but end up ignoring the social, economic, political, and cultural dimensions of the issue. And by being quite general, this narrative of climate change equals more migration and displacement really risk missing the complexity and context specificity of the links between climate change, migration, displacement, and conflict, which is exactly what we try to better understand in our report, looking at the cases of Bangladesh and Central Asia. Because indeed, if you miss these links, you'll miss the chance of coming up with effective responses that address the needs of migrants, as well as their home countries and destination countries and communities.
Thank you, Beatrice. As you just said, the report explored 2 case studies, so Bangladesh and Central Asia. Let's start with Bangladesh, because this is more of an obvious case of rapid and constant change. And I think it's also one of the textbook examples of how climate change is linked to fragility. Bangladesh has an extremely fragile coast. It endures monsoons, hurricanes, landslides, sea level rise, and even droughts in its higher plains. But at the same time, mobility in the region shouldn't be very easy, given that they're surrounded by hard borders and also neighbors with similar climate-related issues. So I'm curious to know what you found out about climate-related migration in Bangladesh.
Well, taking it back a step, I mean, Bangladesh is, as you say, very vulnerable to a whole range of disasters. And Bangladesh recognized early on that climate change is going to increase its vulnerability to potentially cyclones and so on. I mean, it's worth making the point that the actual foundation of Bangladesh in part came about because of a very poor government response when it was part of Pakistan to a cyclone in 1970 that killed something up to 500,000 people. And so with that as its genesis, the government has taken a lot of steps both to warn the world of the implications of climate change, but also to prepare its population for disasters. So cyclones now are something that can be managed as opposed to something that kill vast numbers of people. But having said that, as you say, a lot of it is low-lying. It's very vulnerable to floods. Even now, a large percentage of people moving into Dhaka, the largest city, say that environmental reasons are responsible. It's the densest populated country in the world, aside from city-states. And that means one of the causes of internal migration is people's land literally falling into rivers at times of flooding and their land disappearing. One of the issues it faces is that it had one city that's vastly larger than the rest. So Dhaka is the place to which the vast majority of internal migrants go. But you also have a trend for external migration. And historically, that's been in large numbers into India, though that's becoming more difficult. But also wherever there are routes for migrants, a lot of people, particularly men, turn up. So a couple of years ago, when people started moving from Libya into Italy, Bangladesh was the second most represented nationality after Syrians. So wherever there are routes for migration, people are there. And it's largely disasters and it's largely environmental factors now that's responsible for migration, whether internal or external. And really, as climate change intensifies, that problem's going to increase.
It's very complex. Thank you, Gareth.
And now let's look at Central Asia. So as far as I know, water availability and distribution among Central Asian countries, particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union, is one of the most pressing issues in the region, especially in light of inequalities between upstream and downstream countries and contentious dam projects. We have a few case studies on this in the Climate Diplomacy Platform, and I think you get into many of these issues in the report, but I wasn't aware of migration in the region. Are these two issues interlinked?
Yes, there is migration in Central Asia, and one could definitely say that it is linked to availability of and access to natural resources, including, of course, as you mentioned, water. So at that point, one can easily draw the link between migration and climate change, as we know that climate change will likely bring about more frequent heavy rain events, but also drought and lengthened dry spells in some parts of the region. So all in all, threatening agricultural livelihoods, livestock, human settlements, and food security. But actually, what is really interesting in the case of Central Asia, and very different from what Gareth was just describing for Bangladesh, is that this link between climate impact, environmental degradation, and migration and mobility was not so direct. We actually found that economic factors are the predominant cause of movement. So people moving in search for better livelihoods and higher wages in the face of increasing unemployment and decreasing real incomes, particularly in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, which remain the poorest countries in the region. Now, the history of the countries of Central Asia is certainly too complex to be told here. We will need another episode of our podcast. But let me just say that these are all countries that, after the fall of the Soviet Union and their independence in 1991, have faced significant developmental challenges, having to move from a planned centralized economy to becoming sort of liberal markets. And today, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan are all largely characterized by persistent poverty, high levels of unemployment, particularly among the youth in an economy, and this is crucial here, that remains highly dependent on the agricultural sector to generate jobs and services. So it comes with little surprise that people have migrated mainly to the richest parts of the region. So we're talking here about the kind of regional mobility dynamics, for example, moving to Russia and Kazakhstan, whose oil-rich economies have created a high demand for foreign labor. But what is crucial to highlight here, what we found in our report is that, yes, economic drivers are the main ones beyond vast regional mobility in this case, but these economic drivers are being made more urgent by the impacts of climate change. So here comes the link to climate change, particularly as these impacts tend to manifest very strongly in the agricultural sector, which again accounts for a significant share of employment in Central Asian countries, I think up to 53% in Tajikistan, for example. And then, of course, when we talk about the links between climate change and mobility, we also need to think of a displacement, of course, that is linked to natural disasters. We're very much seeing this in Central Asia, where floods, mudslides, landslides are very common and increasing in frequency and intensity because of climate change. And interestingly, here we saw that these rapid onset events cause a temporary reduction in financial means and livelihood constraints, and therefore increase the desire for people to migrate. But then at this point, people tend to prioritize internal migration. So we're seeing less cross-regional migration in the case of rapid onset events. People move to less dangerous areas, but areas that a movement route that is cheaper than cross-border migration, and then makes it easy for people also to come back after the emergency is over.
We always like to bring in the gender perspective in our podcast. So migration and gender have a very strong connection, arguably one of the strongest disparities when it comes to gender imbalance and climate change. Given how much gender defines who migrates and who stays behind, did you encounter any new or interesting gender-related aspects when going through the case studies?
We certainly did for Central Asia, where migration is predominantly a male phenomenon, although it has to be said that this differs slightly between countries. So, for example, Kyrgyzstan experiences more female migration than the other two countries, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, in the region. So what happens is, because it's largely men that live and women that stay at home, migration ends up putting a lot of stress on women. They might become dependent on remittances sent by their husband, by their partner, their brother or cousin or male relative that has migrated. So if the remittances stop coming, they face economic hardship. And we saw this very much during the COVID-19 pandemic. They also often have to take on additional caring roles, acting as parents if they have children, but also taking care of the elderly. And this becomes particularly difficult in a situation of economic stress. Not to mention that in many cases, men just don't come home. Maybe they remarry in the destination countries, leaving women at home in a vulnerable situation, maybe to be taken care of by other male relatives, which of course can reinforce harmful gender dynamics. But maybe going a little bit beyond gender, what we also found interesting in the case of Central Asia was that income and social status was an important factor in shaping mobility decisions and patterns, because actually migration is simply not an affordable choice for many. For example, in Tajikistan, there's evidence that droughts lead to an increase in migration throughout the year. But if we look at increased rainfall, that was only associated with increased movements in winter, which is the planting season, so a season where many seasonal migrants also return, but not in the rest of the year, because in the rest of the year, migration is not an option. People don't have enough money to move.
In the case of Bangladesh, historically, women and children were much more vulnerable to disasters. There's a major cyclone hit in 1991, and it's estimated that 90% of the 140,000 people who died were women. The government of Bangladesh has paid a lot of attention to healthcare and literacy, so those kind of gender disparities are likely to be less marked now. But you certainly saw differences in terms of internal migration, whereby women were more likely to move at times to work in the garment industry in Dhaka. In terms of external migration, as I mentioned, that's very much dominated by male migrants. And it's also worth mentioning that in the event of disasters, children are much at risk. And so Bangladesh is one of quite a few countries where drowning is the major cause of death for children under the age of 5. So definitely there are gender disparities, and in terms of the patterns of migration, and also whilst many more women than men move to work in the garment industry, the main cause of women's migration is for family reasons.
You've mentioned that migration can and often is a strategy for adapting to climate change, and I think this is certainly something worth exploring. Is this already being considered on the policy level as part of broader adaptation plans?
Yes, and within Bangladesh, the government is very much aware of it. It's had a number of plans. One of the most interesting things, because so much migration is concentrated on Dhaka, trying to build up second-tier cities and so forth to provide alternative places for internal migration. In terms of external migration, countries like Bangladesh, along with many countries in South Asia and Central Asia, remittances are very important. But the level of understanding of the importance is lower than one might have thought. So that, for instance, at the start of the COVID pandemic, numerous organizations suggested that economies like Bangladesh, like Nepal, for instance, would suffer dramatically from the lack of opportunities for workers overseas. When in reality, as COVID progressed, the amount of official remittances actually rose. Now, what this implies is that much more remittances historically had been remitted maybe with cash, with gold and so forth, than through the official channels, because clearly those overseas workers, in some, the remittances must have come down because workers were struggling to work overseas. But the official figures through the formal banking sector rose because the opportunities to travel back with a suitcase full of cash or whatever were limited because of COVID restrictions. Now, what that implies is that the importance of remittances from those external migrants, whether climate change related or not, has been much underestimated in their importance to economies like Bangladesh.
And I think we can say something very similar here in the case of Central Asia. I think governments still kind of struggle to establish policies that address this linkage or take this linkage into account. I think until quite recently, these countries have also struggled to establish policies to address the impacts of climate change in the first place. So this situation is slowly improving. Now all the countries have submitted their nationally determined contributions to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, for example. And they're taking steps to integrate climate change considerations into sectoral policies and sustainable development strategies. The Kyrgyz government, for example, has just adopted a green economy development program for 2019-2023 and established a new coordination mechanism on green economy and climate change. And also, as I mentioned before, given the region's vulnerability to natural disasters, governments have done a lot on disaster risk reduction and management with the support, very critical support of international partners. But again, when it comes to connecting climate change to mobility, action has been very limited, also by international partners. It has to be said, focus has largely been put on displacement, supporting humanitarian assistance efforts, but not so much on addressing issues related to external migration. So we definitely found also in Central Asia the need for programs that focus on climate resilient livelihoods, social protection, particularly in the most environmentally vulnerable parts of the region, as a way also to address potential instability linked to climate-induced mobility.
Thank you. I think this gets into the topic that I would like to address right now, which is on the policy conversation. I think you probably started to answer this question, but you might have some other insights. In light of all these push and pull factors behind human mobility that we've been speaking about, there are actually some possibilities to explore and also pathways for better understanding and integrating human mobility into the policy conversation. Would you walk us through the recommendations that you've outlined in the report?
Of course. Maybe I'll go first and then Gareth, you can continue. So yes, we did identify five areas for the governments in the countries that we looked at, but also focusing on international development and humanitarian actors that work in these countries, work in these regions or with these countries and with these regions to address these linkages between mobility and climate change, while, and this is really important, working towards reducing the drivers and root causes of vulnerability and insecurity. First of all, there's a need to increase knowledge and awareness of climate-induced mobility, which can and should be done by supporting the collection of data on internal and cross-border movements. Importantly, these data need to be sex and age disaggregated at the very least to understand these complex dynamics that we're seeing and these differences between different groups that we're seeing, but also through commissioning policy-relevant research that looks and understands these complex dynamics behind human mobility in connection to climate change. And of course, then there's the need to the next step and promote adaptation and development, prioritizing investments in service provision and infrastructure, particularly in urban areas, and particularly, as Gareth was saying before, in the second-tier cities, so that they also become a viable alternative to large cities for mobility, for migration. But also these investments need to not forget nature-based solutions to protect against climate-based risks, while also providing livelihoods, say, for example, projects like focusing on land restoration or mangrove protection and so on. Disaster risk management remains very important, of course, and investing in the land-based green jobs that can be a viable and cost-effective alternative to unemployment and land abandonment.
In addition, focus needs to be put on financing responses to climate-induced migration and displacement by supporting existing international mechanisms, such as the International Organization of Migration's Development Fund and the Green Climate Fund, and also strengthening the role of the private sector, for example, in terms of improving access to insurance and risk management instruments, and encouraging competition to lower the cost of services, such as sending through remittances. And finally, strong global action and cooperation on climate-induced migration will be needed to facilitate the negotiation of bilateral and sub-regional agreements for freedom of movement and access to labour markets, to ensure policy coherence between sectors and organisations, to address inconsistencies that can make existing policies ineffective or harmful, and of course, driving global mitigation efforts so that the worst impacts of climate change can be avoided.
There are some very good points in there. And I find especially interesting the idea of making second-tier cities more attractive to avoid uncontrolled urbanization in big urban centers, which is also, as we know, connected to several issues around human security and environmental degradation. I guess this is an important but often understated form of adaptation to climate impacts. And you make a good point, Garrett. We do have the international mechanisms in place for addressing all these issues. they require support, financing. Basically, they must be put to practice.
Bea and Gareth, thank you both for joining us today. Climate induced migration and displacement is such an important topic, and it was great that we could unpack it together. Let's now summarize what we discussed today. First, you presented your findings from the Rethinking Human Mobility in the Face of Global Changes Cascades report. For our listeners, you find the link to the report in the episode description. You explained prevailing trends on human mobility in regards to climate change, as well as the role climate change plays in exacerbating fragility and conflict, which also impacts human mobility. Together, we explored different narratives around migration. You explained that the narrative of climate change leading to more migration ignores important links between the two topics. You researched these links further in the two case studies, which we also discussed, because this information is important to find adequate policy responses. Then, we spoke about climate change-related migration in Bangladesh, the first of your case studies. The government took many steps to manage extreme weather events, but still, environmental reasons are responsible for internal and most of the external migration to India and other destinations. We also looked at Central Asia, the second case study, where climate change is likely to bring more lengthy and frequent extreme weather events, threatening livelihoods, culture, and the economy. The link between climate impacts, environmental degradation, and migration is not as pronounced. In Central Asia, economic drivers are the main drivers for migration, but they are made more urgent by climate change, particularly in the agricultural sector. We discussed that migration and gender have a very strong connection. In your report, you found that this is more pronounced in Central Asia, where mostly men leave and women become dependent on their remittances. If the remittances stop coming, women face economic hardship. This was exacerbated during the COVID-19 pandemic. In Bangladesh, women were historically more vulnerable to extreme weather events. Children in Bangladesh are most at risk, with drowning being their major cause of death.
Well, Hannah, there's quite a lot to consider around climate-induced mobility, and the picture is far more complex than what we see on the news. But luckily, today's guests did outline some ways to deal with this. The Cascades report identifies 5 entry points for informing governments, policies, and programs in relation to mobility. Let's review them. Firstly, there's a need to increase knowledge and awareness around climate-induced mobility, collect data, disaggregate it, for example, by age and sex, which will allow us to understand what is going on, why, how, and who is it affecting in which ways. Commissioning policy-relevant research to understand these dynamics will ensure this new knowledge can effectively inform policymaking. Secondly, promoting adaptation and development, prioritizing investments in service provision and infrastructure in urban areas, particularly the so-called second-tier cities, can help buffer fast urbanization and all the developmental and environmental issues that come with it. And here there should be a focus on nature-based solutions, which are much cheaper alternatives to engineering solutions for adapting to climate change by making use of what nature has to offer in a given place, and nature has always something to offer. Another important pathway is to integrate mobility and climate change into governmental action and develop and strengthen policies at all levels. Providing displaced people and migrants with access to basic services and facilitating their integration into communities goes a long way, but all of this must follow international standards related to the protection of migrants. Supporting rural development, land access, and land tenure is important both to avoid forced displacement and to support integration. And facilitating mobility by fostering regular migration pathways and supporting educational opportunities for migrants can ensure both the country of origin and the host country can benefit from the positive impacts that migration can have on several sectors. And then we have finance. More specifically, the financing of responses to climate-induced migration and displacement. Here, it is crucial to support international funds and ensure governments can have access to these funds to prevent and cope with climate change impacts on migration. The private sector can play a role, for example, in improving access to insurance and risk management instruments. And finally, the last pathways looks towards cooperation. We must drive strong global action and cooperation on climate-induced migration and displacement to help build networks of laws and standards at all levels for managing and facilitating cross-border mobility. And most critically, especially in light of the clear warnings of the recent IPCC report, driving global efforts throughout all sectors and including all actors to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. Full stop. Thank you so much, Beatrice Mosello and Garrett Price, once again for joining us today. It was really very interesting to dive deeper into the topic of human mobility in face of global changes. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. Meanwhile, you can reach us with questions and feedback on our Twitter channel at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.
Thanks, you too.
That's great. Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
Have a good evening.
Bye. Yeah, you too.